Good morning. I'm delighted to be here. WaterFire has been a great gift to me by the community. It has only been made possible by the many thousands and literally thousands of people who have come forward to share their time, their skills, their help, and their contributions, both in spirit and in resources, that have made this dream a reality, and even more so, the thousands who've come to be part of the event, because it's conceived as an event that everyone who attends is also part of the artwork itself. Carlo Rotella once wrote about WaterFire in a wonderful essay that it is not a community celebration, but is instead a celebration of community itself. It is indeed a civic ritual, a work of metaphor and spirituality, and a right to weave us all together, to bring the entire community in celebration of all we hold in common. One of the gifts of WaterFire is getting things like poems sent to us in the mail. And I'll read one by Robert Runno, a quite fairly well-known poet. This is from his third collection that was published in 2004. It's a poem titled Providence. In disaster and war movies, the protagonist queen and her immediate circle are protected from anonymous death. They may die, one by one or all at once, but someone at least grieves, or the audience is alternatively full of glee. But in Star Wars, for instance, what about the many hundreds of nameless, faceless soldiers in body armor and visored helmets, or planetary citizens who fall by the scores or more like the leaves this rich fall? I think no one thinks how one of them may have had her first lover the night before, and one may be leaving behind two sons he read to last night and loved with all his heart. Neither belief in God nor being a God so entertained can explain and forgive this oversight. Ah, how sweet the film in which no actor dies, or if they do, it's from their own disease or golden age. People grieve for the soul that left and celebrate the soul that flew. I was in Providence for a conference, a town I had thought insignificant, not a city to be considered a city in flight. But that night, they lit 100 bonfires in the river, running up through the streets, and the face of every girl and woman with her lover by firelight was beautiful. Had this city been nuked by a terrorist or rogue nation, I would not have minded dying there with them that night. It is possible to be several billion strong and every homeless man with a singing voice belong. Interesting to have that come in the mail. So we extinguished some 300 electrical lights that are powered by fossil fuels to return our city to the primacy of darkness and then re-illuminate the city anew in an ancient light. So the city is seen again from reclaimed firewood. Thank you for having me here this morning. I've been here often and have great respect for this congregation and all the work you do, and a deep love for this particular meeting house. There are so many connections. Among them, I was delighted to discover that one of your previous ministers was an old girlfriend of mine. Whether I helped inspire her to the ministry or drove her to the nunnery, that's for her to say. I can tell you that she came to WaterFire several times. I didn't realize she was here while she was here. And after spending many times with you, she came at the end of the last WaterFire while she'd been here and told me that WaterFire was indeed a work of art, but I hadn't told her that it was also a spiritual ministry. I see the world simultaneously through four different but reinforcing perspectives, As a humanist and a devotee of words, as a scientist, as an artist, and as a symbolist who sees the world through metaphor, these perspectives are sometimes portrayed as being in opposition, but I find their different nuances to be richly reinforcing, and I hope to share some of these perspectives with you this morning. You may find some of them jarring, but please know they are offered with great respect. I love this meeting house, your third. When I sit here, which is fairly often, I always delight in so many details of this building, but I'll only share one with you. I love that on either side of this pulpit are a matched set of incredibly gracefully built arch windows, that instead of stained glass, illustrations contain the delicate, transparent tracery of antique crown glass with slight coloring that permits the light of the world to stream into the sanctuary of this meeting place. It's a little cloudy today. There is a delicate haiku here with the view of the two windows on either side of the pulpit. On the right, on your right to the south, is the solid declaration of the primacy of granite in the parish house. Masons were long near ritual force for truth in our world because they understood the mysteries of gravity. Cormac McCarthy once put it in his character Pawpaw, a black grandfather who'd been a stonemason for many generations, that the stonemason's trade remains esoteric because it's the foundation and the hearth of the human soul. I'm still quoting McCarthy. It's not the mortar that holds the work. What holds the stone trues the wall. His plumb bob never lies. It never lies, and it points motionless to the unimaginable center of the earth 4,000 miles beneath his feet, pointing to a blackness unknown and unknowable, both in truth and in principle, where God and matter are locked in a collaboration that is silent nowhere in the universe. And it is this that guides him, as it did his fathers before him and his sons to follow, as he lays the stone. So there in the south window is the solidity of man's studied response to the natural laws of gravity, lightly contrasted with a tree. The north window is a delicate study in contrast in this haiku. Here, two trees are always the dominant form with their irregular rhythms of natural growth, with wood of the growing green earth equally strong as stone. But far beyond them, there is the delicate, perfect cube of the great scientist Zachariah Allen's house in repose. It could not be more perfect, and it has been that way for the past near 50 years that I have been coming into this very room. Yet I know this composition came about by happenstance. Zachariah Allen built his house 50 years after the third meeting house opened. The parish house arrived 13 years after that, and the dog was planted 135 years after the meeting house opened. Who is the master creator of this composition we enjoy here? Such is the world, for each of us is a creator. The human mind is a fine instrument to manufacture meaning. Indeed, science's aim is often to harness our propensity to find meaning in error. I am an artist, but I was trained as a scientist. My father, too, was a scientist who worked to end nuclear testing of atomic weapons. He witnessed personally, several hundred atomic bomb explosions. From Nevada to Aniwetok to the Marshall Islands, as he monitored their impact on people and troops in the environment, they would be tested, but he was there in the field holding the Geiger counters on them. He became deep friends with many of the Pacific Islanders and felt that the U.S. had betrayed them and destroyed their heritage and their lands. He became a committed environmentalist in his life and his work for as long as he lived. We have too much of a divide between the scientific and the artistic perspectives and understandings of the world from the humanist experience, from the quotidian and commercial life we all rush forward to every day. Not enough of us are literate in these two other languages. Incidentally, the word scientist is a fairly recent word. coined in 1834 as a suggestion in a conference by William Whewell in London to solve a problem they all faced, as there was no word for what science was doing. The prior name was natural philosopher, and Whewell's new coinage was deliberately and consciously based on the word artist. There were other different names considered at the time by Whewell and others, like cultivators of science and savants. Savants was immediately dismissed, not for the reason you're thinking. This was London. It was too French. They were not happy with the word, and their prime concern was confusion with two deeply negative alternative words, the first being economist. They feared economist, and lesser so, they feared the word atheist. C.P. Snow stated in the 59 Reed Lecture in Cambridge, and I might note that the original and my preferred name of that lecture series was the Barnaby Lectures, but we now call them, after the scientist, Reed. This is C.P. Snow, and you probably can read along with me. Many times I have been at gatherings of people who are thought highly educated and who have expressed their incredulity at the utter illiteracy of scientists. Once or twice, I have asked how many of them could describe the second law of thermodynamics. The response was cold. It was also negative, and I might add, not understanding. Yet I was asking something which is the scientific equivalent of, have they ever read a single work of William Shakespeare? I now believe that if I had asked an even simpler question, such as, what do we mean by mass? Which is the scientific equivalent of saying, can you read? Not more than 1 in 10 of this highly educated group would have felt that I was even speaking the same language to them. So the great edifice of modern physics goes up, and the majority of the cleverest people in our Western world have about as much insight into it as their Neolithic ancestors would ever have had. This is part of our problem with climate change, as the scientists go to great efforts to conservatively, modestly lay out this challenge, and people fail to understand what they're saying. Earlier, and I think it might even be precisely today, I couldn't nail it down, 100 years ago today, at the inaugural first Tanner lecture at Trinity College, also in Cambridge, the great scientist Alfred North Whitehead tried to capture the essence of the scientist's goal in studying the world. It was November 1919. I think it was the 15th. I agree that the view of nature, which I have maintained in these lectures, is not a simple one. Nature appears as a complex system whose factors are dimly discerned by us. But as I ask you, is not this the very truth? Should we not distrust that jaunty assurance which every age prides itself that it has at last hit upon the ultimate concepts in which all that happens can be formulated? The aim of science is to seek the simplest explanations of very complex facts. We are apt to fall into the error of thinking that the facts are simple because simplicity is also the goal of our quest. The guiding motto in the life of every natural philosopher, you'll note he doesn't use scientist at this stage, should be seek simplicity and distrust it. But a viewpoint of science can yield dramatically different results when applied to a text. Just two nights ago in this very room, I was here when Karen Armstrong said with great verve and wit that with each recitation of a religious text, one should come away with a different meaning. The poetry of this is wonderful, but in Shannon's mathematical development of information theory, this is almost the exact definition of a meaningless text. If each person who reads it, or each time you reread it, you come up with another meaning, information theory would have said it's been so distorted in transmission as to no longer have coherent information. But the power of the mind to create useful meaning is profound and also beautiful. I spoke of reweaving the rainbow, and Nancy found a wonderful photograph of a double rainbow, which she put on the cover for us this morning. I had to admit a quick spasm of worry, as most photographs of double rainbows are fakes. But Nancy, as always, was true. This is a real double rainbow. And if you know geometry and the physics behind the rainbow, there are three immediately obvious errors in all the fakes we see all the time. All three of them are correct in this. And this is the great value of citizens knowing science. It's a truth detector. It can immediately tell you that this is not a correct photograph. In this case, it is. Because all these things have consilience and congruity and reinforcements. There's a false thought, I would say false, that knowing the science behind something somehow robs it of its magic. Newton discovered the colors of the rainbow in his prism experiments, and this is reflected in John Keats's poem, where in 1819 he was again using philosophy as in the meaning of science. Quote, "Do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We know her woof, her texture." That's awful in the divine sense. She is given in the dull catalog of common things. Philosophy will clip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and lime, empty the haunted air and gnomed mind, and unweave a rainbow. I feel Keats was wrong. Science opens up the universe with stunning beauty to our comprehension and to our aesthetic delight. Mankind has experienced and seen so little of the world. Beyond all the wonderful hues of the rainbow, we are blind to a vast world. We see only 0.0035% of the electromagnetic spectrum. And it's wonderful what we see. Many animals see far beyond it. Yet science has expanded our human senses to see all of it in glory and amazement. We ourselves are middling in size and incapable of seeing the small or even imagining the gargantuan. Yet with science, we have seen the quivering atoms of carbon, and we can sense particles millions of times smaller than atoms. At the same time, we have reached all across the entire universe to see an unimaginable distance. And we live a mere 100 years if we're lucky. 0.00007% of the time since the Big Bang. Yet science has found ways to go back in time to the birth of our planet and nearly back to the Big Bang itself, so that we can see an immense universe of time that stretches out behind us at the speed of light. This is magic and full of perspectives and understanding and absolutely sheer beauty. We must reweave the rainbow and retain all its beauty and add to its wonder. We are told in Genesis 9:11, that, quote, "I establish my covenant with you and with every living creature, shall not be cut off any more by the waters of a flood, neither shall there any more be a flood to destroy the earth. For perpetual generations I do set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be a token of a covenant between me and the earth, and the waters shall no more become a flood." We have unwoven that rainbow. We are now looking at a deluge. It didn't come from God. It came from us. Noah's flood, with the climate crisis of sea level rise, we see our rainbow covenant becoming unwoven, but we are the ones who've destroyed it. Again, this is partially because we cannot see the world that science is presenting to us. Incidentally, the science has actually found the localized flood that is the root cause of all of these oft-recurring stories, for the Genesis story is an almost exact recording of the Gilgamesh story, recorded in clay 2,800 years before the New Testament. But the roots of this tragedy also start in Genesis with verse 126. "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." Some argue that this Bible passage, more than anything else in our entire culture, has sent us all down a wrong path. Some argue it's based in a mistranslation from the original Aramaic and Hebrew. The word rada, or more precisely, resh, dalet, hey, is not meant to mean dominion or ownership. Instead, the verse is better rendered as a commandment for man to be the responsible stewards of the earth. Mankind's task is to safeguard, protect, and defend all the earth and all its creatures and God's creation, and to care for them in trust, not for ourselves, but for the creatures themselves, and for God as a sacred trust. We're now facing a profound moral crisis of understanding, and our entire world has been turned into a machine for pillaging the world. This drunken, destructive consumerism has been going on to some extent since the Industrial Revolution, but it shifted into overdrive only recently, in the mid-1950s, not even 70 years ago, and we have now deeply damaged our entire planet. We were taught how to be this rapacious, deliberately. Here is the advertising strategist Victor Lebeau writing to the ad industry about the necessity that the ad industry had to do to increase business for manufacturers after the fall off after the great disaster of World War II. Quote, this is spring 1955, in an in-house, the Journal of Retailing, which was one advertising agency to another. Probably the most powerful weapon will be the use of television. Our enormous productive economy demands that we make consumption now our way of life, that we convert the buying public and their use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfactions, our ego satisfactions, in consumption. The measure of social status, the social acceptance of prestige, is now to be found in our consumptive patterns. The very meaning and significance of our lives today will be expressed in consumptive terms. The greater the pressures upon the individual to conform to safe and accepted social standards, the more does he tend to express his aspirations and his individuality in terms of what he consumes. These commodities and services must be offered to the consumer with a special urgency. We require not only the forced draft of a furnace as consumption, but expensive consumption as well. We need things consumed, burned up, worn out, replaced, and discarded at an ever-increasing pace. This is a strategic plan. We need to have people eat, drink, dress, ride, live with ever more complicated and therefore constantly more expensive consumption. What becomes clear is that from the larger viewpoint of our economy, the total effect of all the advertising and promotion is to create and maintain the multiplicity and the intensity of wants that are the spur to our manufacturers and to the standard of living in the United States. A specific advertising and promotional campaign for a particular product at a particular time has no automatic guarantee of success, yet it may contribute to the general pressure by which wants are stimulated and maintained. Thus, its very, very failure may serve to fertilize this soil, as does so much else that seems to go down the drain. As we imagine the concept of consumer loyalty, we see that the whole problem of molding the American mind is involved here. This was a conceptualized strategy by the ad agencies, as expressed in an internal magazine. It's frightening to imagine this is a real document from 1955. And it's also frightening how successful they were in changing our worlds. We have been warned by scientists of the dangers of the carbon economy for 184 years now. The first message of all people was written by Charles Babbage in 1835, when he stated the chemical changes which thus take place, he was talking about the industrial mills burning coal, which thus take place are constantly increasing the atmosphere by large quantities of carbonic acid, which was their term in the day for carbon dioxide, and other gases noxious to life. The means by which nature decomposes these elements or perhaps reconverts them into a solid form, is not sufficiently known. There's a warning in 1835, and 60 years later, Cervantes Arenas published in 1896 on the influence of carbonic acid in the air upon the temperature of the ground, where he very correctly and remarkably accurately said climate change was going to be a problem. Earlier, I played the last work that Schubert completed before his death at the age of 31. It is a poem of a man facing death alone, isolated, and utterly rejected from his community. This performance by Thomas Quasthoff is one we always play at Waterfire. Sorry, this is making little beeping noises. I always feel he captures in his voice the profound isolation of an individual facing rejection from his society and facing death all alone. There's a reason for the profundity of his sorrow. Thomas Quasthoff was a thalidomide baby who did survive. He was inadvertently exposed in the womb and survived birth with a wide range of severe birth defects. He was fascinated with music, but was never allowed to enter the music academy because, having no arms and having only three vestigial fingers, he could not meet the obligatory piano recital requirement for entrance. He studied privately, and he expressed his music entirely through his voice. You can hear that in that version of Schubert's last song. We must recognize the power of man-made chemicals in our midst and our environment and better understand as a society how carefully we need to review their introduction, or the death he sings about will become the death of mankind. And not just mankind, because our actions are threatening the entire planet. We must listen to what the scientists have been saying for 184 years, and our children are listening. Greta Thunberg is stunningly clear and direct when she speaks to us, with urgency, candor, and brave honesty. To quote her, and you've heard this, "I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists. I want you to unite behind the science, and I want you to take real action. This is all wrong. I shouldn't be up here. I should be back in school on the other side of the ocean, yet all of you come to us young people to give you hope. How dare you? You have stolen my hope, my dreams, and my childhood with your empty words. Entire ecosystems are collapsing. We are in the beginning of a mass extinction, and all you talk about is money and fairy tales of eternal economic growth. How dare you? For more than 30 years, the science has been crystal clear. How dare you continue to look away and come here saying that you've done enough when the politics and solutions needed are still nowhere in sight? You are failing us. But the young people are starting to understand your betrayal, and the eyes of all future generations are upon you. And if you choose to fail us, we will never forgive you." Greta received withering criticism for that. Sebastian Gorka, the Trump advisor, said that Thunberg's, quote, "performance is like a victim of a Maoist re-education camp and opined that the adults who brainwashed this autistic child should be brought up on child abuse charges." Michael Knowles claimed that what he called the climate hysteria movement is not about science. If it were, it would be led by scientists, not by children and a mentally ill Swedish child who is being exploited by her parents and by the international leftists. And Greta responded again with such grace and directness. Quote, "They come up with every thinkable lie and conspiracy theory. It seems they will cross every possible line to avert the focus, change the topic, since they are so desperate not to talk about the climate and ecological crisis. The current best available science is not opinions, it's facts. I honestly don't understand why adults would choose to spend their time mocking and threatening teenagers and children for promoting science when they could do something useful instead. I guess they must simply feel so threatened by us. I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists. I want you to unite behind the science, and I want you to take real action. We have done this before. We were warned that the ozone layer, about the ozone layer, and we rallied to fix it. And before this, Rachel Carson warned us about DDT, and we resolved to save ourselves and the birds of this planet. As our next piece of music, I would like you to listen to a symphony of the world as it says good night to the daylight and settles in for the long night. This was recorded in a high mountain lake in western Washington by the gifted ecologist and the sound recordist Gordon Hempton. I play it in dedication to all the creatures who are properly under our stewardship on this earth. Genesis called us to respect the fish, the birds, the animals, and those that creepeth upon the earth. And they are all here speaking to you in this recording. We start and end with those who creepeth, with the high hum of thousands of insects you can hear in the air. The water sounds are the scores of trout hungrily gulping down insects from the lake surface. And the birds all come forth in their appointed order in the score as it gently gets darker and darker until the creeping creatures return with the frogs appearing to chorus us into dusk and night. Listen for just 5 minutes of what is a much longer symphony and ponder the stability and scientific complexity of the hundreds of animals and ecosystems here, their beauty, their fragility, the ritual, theater, and communion of this magnificent community of creatures who arose in balanced equilibrium through natural selection over millennia on our planets. The many birds here are all related to the dinosaurs of 200 billion years ago. So let us pledge that we can engage with each other, commit to understanding each other and the science so we can save our planet, so that this night symphony will continue and these animals will not go silent as they are forced to add their voices to our dying song. Thank you.